first of all, I'd like to thank the Institute for and the organizers for asking me to attend. It's an opportunity for me to learn from you and also to share some of the things that I enjoy doing at Washington University in St. Louis. I should say a few things about my background. But before I do that, I'd like to have a show of hands. How many people here are undergraduates? Okay, graduate students? Okay. And the rest are just stragglers coming for a free cup of coffee. So just by way of background, my background training is in engineering and theoretical physics. And after I got my PhD in physics, I got interested in applying physical principles to biological systems. And so I went to medical school. And after medical school, I went to Washington University in St. Louis and trained in internal medicine and cardiology. So I'm a licensed cardiologist. I carry a stethoscope. I examine people. I'm an invasive cardiologist, which means I have the license to kill. And I do invasive cardiac catheterizations. And some of the data that you'll be seeing, which I use for my research, comes from patients in the cardiac cath lab, where I deliver health care for Medicare and various other things as part of my job, okay? But one of the things that I'm interested in is applying physical principles and the methods that physical scientists use to solve problems, the problems in biology, and that's why this is the area that we're going to discuss. I wanted to go from imaging and modeling combined, and I made some comments earlier about how people discover things through correlation, and I want to try to invoke causality as part of the paradigm by which I want to understand what are the things that I'm looking at through imaging, what does it mean, and therefore explain the things that people see. And I've picked a very specific physiologic and cardiovascular theme for your benefit. Cardiology is very broad. It involves arrhythmias. It involves how the heart works. It involves, I mean, not many of you think of it, but actually your heart is an endocrine organ. It makes a hormone, atrial natriuretic peptide. And you don't think of your heart as an organ that's an endocrine organ. You think of your pancreas, maybe. I'm assuming you know that you have a pancreas. I need to tell you that when I was a graduate student at Caltech, I thought that the number of kidneys in man was pi. Because it seemed like a very natural number. I was pretty close. Anyway, so I'm going to talk about how the heart fills with blood. It's actually an interesting problem because it's got some aspects which are intuitive, some aspects which are counterintuitive, and it's turning into a pertinent part of clinical cardiology. Why does it matter? Well, it matters, and it was mentioned earlier, that a huge number of people now get hospitalized with a thing called heart failure. And heart failure, when I trained, was just called heart failure, or congestive heart failure. And now people are becoming more specific, and they say, well, it's systolic heart failure or diastolic heart failure. Systolic is the squeeze, and diastolic is the filling. I know that not all of you went to medical school, obviously, and so if I say things you don't understand, then you need to raise your hand. Now, when it comes to when you go buy a car, you look on the window sticker, it says Porsche 911, 364 horsepower. And you can put it on a dynamometer and you can check, and indeed, you know, at so many RPMs, that's what it delivers. That's for all graduate students driving California, I suppose. When it comes to the heart, it's actually an unsolved problem, which is none of you can walk up to a cardiologist and say, how good a diastolic filling motor is my heart. They can tell you how good a systolic squeeze your heart does, but they can't tell you the diastolic portion. And so if you're interested in physical sciences, right away you should say, that's very peculiar, because the heart is an oscillator. It goes like this. And how come you know this part but don't know this part? Okay? And so that's one of the motivations for this kind of a thing. So before I go into further details, I need to stop. I need to get all of us to understand the same set of words. So so that we can communicate more effectively. And I'll just do a quick review of anatomy. Here's the canonical picture of the human torso with the heart in the middle of the thorax, in kind of a see-through Superman view. And when you peel things off, this is sort of what you see from the front. I assume that you recognize that as I stand here, my heart is in my chest like this. And below the knuckles, this part, that's the right ventricle. And from here to the wrist, that's the right atrium. And that's the anterior-most part of the heart, right behind the sternum, the breastbone. And in the back, I'm not going to take it out and rotate it, it's the left ventricle on this side and the left atrium on top. And that's how it sits. So first of all, most hearts aren't vertical. Okay, they're at an angle, and they're kind of point from back to front, if you will. And you'll see some of the slices you've seen before in the cardiac MR series, which I'll show you. You'll get a much better appreciation of how things reside. There are additional features. There are coronary arteries on the surface. And of course, the heart sits in a pericardial sac. And the pericardial sac is an interesting thing. You should think of it, or at least I think of it. It's not like shrink wrap, but it's like shrink wrap, except it's elastic. And it's got a little bit of fluid in it so that when your heart beats, it can slide. Think of it as like a frictionless bearing, pretty much. You can't feel it. If the surfaces of the tissue get irritated, then you get a thing called pericarditis, and you can feel it. It's uncomfortable and painful. But normally, you don't feel your heartbeat. You don't feel tissue sliding past each other in the same way that when you blink, your eyelid slides smoothly over your eyeball, and you don't feel the sliding motion, but you know that you're blinking. In the same way in your chest, your heart is moving around and you don't feel it. I specifically want to point out that the pericardial sac reflects, not right here where the meat ends and the roots of the great vessels begin, but further up. There's a reason for that. Topologically, the pericardium and the pericardial sac is very interesting. If you, first of all, the heart sits, this is, you understand this picture, you cut out the heart, peel out, and you get this hole in your chest, everything else has been removed. So the four pulmonary veins that drain the lungs and bring the red blood into the atria are in the back, and then the superior and inferior vena cava, and here's the pulmonary artery and the aorta. Topologically, the surface of the pericardial sac is the same as the surface of the heart. You just make a U-turn. So it's like this room, where the pericardial sac surface is the carpet, and you walk along on the carpet. See, then you get to here, and then you walk up the wall that you're coming out, and then you start walking backwards, and that's the surface of the heart itself, which has been removed. So it's topologically the same surface. It's just folded over on itself. Also, you can appreciate, just parenthetically, that if there's fluid in the pericardial sac, it can communicate through various things in the back. But of course, in the front, the heart can just completely float if it's immersed in pericardial fluid. What else do you know other than the anatomy? Well, physiology is useful because we're trying to understand how the heart works. And we're trying to use imaging to gain a better understanding of the rules that it follows when it works. So one of the things that cardiologists use is an ultrasound machine. An ultrasound machine is basically, it's an ultrasound machine. It's got a transducer, a piezoelectric crystal driven at high frequencies, typically megahertz. You apply it to the chest, it sounds wave go into your chest, they hit things, they bounce back, and then you make an image. And so this is the typical sort of cartoon of how a transducer is applied to the chest. You can impedance match between the transducer and the skin by using a clear jelly that's usually applied here by the technologist. And then you can orient this whichever way you want to take various pictures of various slices of the cardiac anatomy. And the beam comes out like a fan, like this. So if you cut it this way, it slices the ventricle this way. But if you rotate your transducer 90 degrees, it goes this way. And of course, Eulerian and Lagrangian coordinates were pointed out to you before. It should be self-evident that the origin of coordinates for ultrasound is the transducer. So there's no absolute coordinate system fixed, and that's why registration relative to the ultrasound transducer is such a challenge when it comes to 3D echo. When you do this, when you take an ultrasound transducer and you aim it at the heart, you can see blood coming from the atrium into the left ventricle. And when you gate the signal so that you only listen for when blood is at the tips of the mitral leaflets, you observe certain flow patterns. And the flow patterns you observe is that the blood comes in two bumps. So although you may not have appreciated it, it turns out that your heart doesn't work symmetrically. It doesn't go fill, squeeze. It goes fill, fill, squeeze. Fill, fill, squeeze. Fill, fill, squeeze. Fill, fill, and I'm not going to show you systole, squeeze, and then you start all over again. The period between the two fills is called diastasis. And when you are jogging or have a final exam and you don't know what the answer is, then your heart rate speeds up. And the first thing that happens is the interval between the first filling and the second filling phases shortens, because there's no real flow during this period. And if your heart rate speeds up even faster than that, then the second squeeze starts crawling up the back of the first squeeze. In other words, when the ventricle first fills, and there used to be a pause, and the atrium squeezed to fill it again, then what will happen is, as while it's filling the bottom half, the atrium starts pushing. And so the, what's called the A wave in echocardiology terminology, A for atrial, E for early, the A wave crawls up the back of the E wave. And it's kind of interesting that you can actually show that the duration of the E wave and the duration of the A wave are relatively heart rate insensitive. They're a little bit heart rate sensitive, but not enormously. So for example, when your heart rate goes from 60 beats a minute, one cycle per second, to 120 beats per minute, you double your heart rate, the duration of the E wave only shortens by about 10% or 15%. It's not intuitively obvious until you think about how things work. By the way, in a mouse, these this duration is typically a half a second, 500 milliseconds, if you're, you know, at rest. In a mouse, the entire cardiac cycle takes milliseconds because the heart rate of a mouse is about 600 beats per minute. So a mouse heart will beat 10 times a second, as opposed to your heart, which is beating once a second. In any event, these are the kind of patterns that you observe for the early and late filling patterns. And so these patterns in clinical cardiology are correlated with certain things. And the kind of things that a clinical cardiologist and others have correlated, they would look at these patterns and say, oh, look, the first one is taller than the second one. So now I'm going to make a ratio, the peak of this divided by the peak of the dimensionless number. So this is velocity as a function of time. This is velocity. So it's called the E to A ratio, E for early, A for late. And so here it's bigger than one. Oh, look, it's less than one. So right away, see, now you get, oh, E to A greater than one, that's good. E to A less than one, that's bad. Okay? So you can see where this desire to dichotomize comes from certain immediate things without any consideration of how these things are made and what they mean. It's just a pattern recognition rule. And of course, then, other than looking at the amplitudes of the waves, then if you're a real academic cardiologist, you say, oh, I'm going to look at the duration. And then somebody says, well, if you got the height and the weight and the width, then if you multiply the two, you get an area. And so, oh, that's called the velocity time interval, the area under the curve. Of course, all of you know from elementary mechanics that the integral of velocity times time is distance. And so the area on this curve has units of centimeters. But when you multiply it by the size of the hole that the blood flowed through, then it's actually the volume of blood that enters the ventricle. in addition to echocardiography, you can do what I do, which is you can take a catheter and you can put it into a heart. In this case, it was put into a dog heart. And we used two catheters, one in the atrium, one in the ventricle. So we recorded the pressure in the atrium, the pressure in the ventricle, and simultaneously did transmitral flow with an echo machine. Okay? And so this just shows you classical fluid mechanics of the kind you learned probably as a sophomore, right? Which means that when the pressure gradient is such that the pressure in the ventricle is lower than the pressure in the atrium, that's the area between these two skinny lines, the fluid accelerates into the ventricle. And then the two pressures cross over, the pressure gradient changes sign, S-I-G-N, and the fluid decelerates. Then nothing happens. Even though the dog is breathing, that's why the pressure is going up. Normally this thing can be flat. And then the atrium goes boing. So the atrial pressure increases and drives additional fluid into the ventricle. And since the ventricle is just sitting there and it's getting some fluid pushed into it, the obvious thing happens. The ventricle gets bigger by the area under this curve and its pressure goes up because you're distending it by pushing it from above. Okay? So this is classical sort of hydrodynamics with the flows. And I just drew that over here so that you have some appreciation of the simultaneity of these things. This is meant to be the ventricular pressure. This is meant to be the ventricular volume. And this is the transmitral flow in the sense of the Doppler E wave. And remember that this is the derivative of this, or this is the integral of this, and the pressure is the pressure. Okay? No, I left off the atrial pressure because there's the dotted line of the atrial pressure. And so by the way, you should notice that the typical gradients that make these flows happen are on the order of a couple of millimeters of mercury. It's not a huge pressure gradient. This is, you can't see the yellow because it's test to see if you're colorblind. But this is a human, this is data in the cath lab of ventricular pressure, aortic root pressure, and ventricular volumes in yellow, showing you how the simultaneous relationships apply. And here's a cartoon which attempts to give you the take-home message, which is rapid filling is the E wave, diastasis in the middle, and then atrial systole give you the Doppler A wave. MVO stands for mitral valve opening. So in the sense of fluid flow, there are two filling phases, the early rapid filling phase. Notice this statement. Look over here. At the instant when the mitral valve opens, the volume of the ventricle starts going up. Valve opens, blood starts pouring in. But when the mitral valve opens, look what the pressure does. The pressure goes down. So what's happening is the mitral valve opens, blood pours in, and as the blood pours in, the pressure gets even lower. And some more blood pours in, and the pressure gets even lower until it reaches a minimum. So what that means is that at the initiation of early rapid filling, the pressure devolume is negative. Now that should get you to stop for a second and think about that. Normally, if you take a water balloon or something, and you add a little water to it, and you'll distend it, what'll happen is depending on the elasticity of the wall, right? If you make the chamber bigger, either the pressure won't change because it's real elastic, or as the volume goes up, the pressure goes up. Here the volume goes up, the pressure goes down. What does that mean? It sucks. That's exactly what it means. So this kinematic rule, which is absolutely correct, means that the way your ventricle fills, or it initiates filling, is when the mitral valve opens, it just goes and it springs back. And it springs back faster, the wall springs apart faster than it can fill. That's why the pressure drops. Otherwise, the pressure can't drop. That's just physics. Okay? And so the ventricle is a suction pump when it starts out. But of course, after diastasis, when it's just sitting there, and the atrium squeezes more blood into it, it's passively distended, and it's just a standard spring. right? You push on it, it distends. It's like blowing up a water polo ball. And here are more of the usual correlations that cardiologists use, and this is the notation you see in the literature. Arrows. One arrow, two arrow, three arrows. Bad, worse, very bad. Okay? And so these are meant to illustrate the patterns that people have observed in E waves and A waves on Doppler echocardiography, the associated hemodynamic findings in the cath lab drawn as cartoons, and their association with things like the mean left atrial pressure. Tau is just a number which tells you how rapidly the pressure is dropping here during atrial balloon relaxation. New York Heart Association class is 1 through 4, meaning that when you have heart failure class 1, you're minimally symptomatic. When you have heart failure class 4, you get shortness of breath just by walking along the, around in the room. And the level of diastolic dysfunction is graded as 1 through 4, whether it's reversible or irreversible. So here's the point that immediately after mitral valve opening, the ventricle decreases its pressure while it increases its volume, and it's a suction pattern. So now we want to go from words and stuff, very theatrical, you know, memorable, all that stuff, to something actually more interesting, which is, can you hypothesize a simple rule that will explain the behavior physiologically, it's consistent with experiment, and make some testable predictions. So the simplest rule you can think of is Newton's law for a thing that goes boing, or okay? And notice that I'm cheating on purpose. I mean, the real heart is very complicated. It's made of lots of things. There are millions and billions of cells, and they're woven, and there are blood vessels, and there's connective tissue, and there are capillaries, and they're organized in a very interesting way architecturally. The cells are woven through the wall of the ventricle, and I'm not saying anything about that at all. I'm not even saying that there's meat and blood. I'm just saying there's kinematic. The thing goes boing, and I'm gonna let me make a guess and see what it leads to. And I'm going to see if I can characterize the E wave, the early filling contour, by this kinematic paradigm. I'm going to impose a set of initial conditions for this harmonic oscillator, which is analogous to the physiology, which is before the mitral valve opens, there's no flow. That's reasonable. So the oscillator starts at rest. And the velocity is therefore zero. However, there is stored elastic strain. In other words, the spring has been stretched. Or compressed, depends on your coordinate choice, by the previous system. So one hypothesis here is that the way the heart goes boing is that the previous systole, the previous contraction, loaded some springs. The springs are passive. And when you let go of the springs, they bounce back. And they make the ventricle spring back, and they fill it with blood by sucking blood from the atrium.
Sandra, do you have questions during your talk?
Sure. People say
that it's not a linear spring, as you've written.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to get results out of the linear spring assumption and thereby?
So that's it's exactly the right question to ask, which is what I try to sort of caution you about, which is, you know, the rule about making things simple but not too simple.
Right.
Okay. So the point is, the simplicity here resides in the fact that by keeping things linear, they become invertible. If you make things nonlinear, you can't invert them uniquely. So that's a plus. The disadvantage is that everybody agrees that everything in physiology is nonlinear. Everything. So here you are making a linear spring assumption that a linear spring drives the ventricle. And see what happens. So the answer is, you see what the prediction is, and you see if it works. The usual test of something. And this kind of paradigm also makes a prediction, right? Just based on kinematics. Depending on the spring constant and the dashpot and their relative magnitudes, you can have underdamped, critically damped, or overdamped oscillation. So one thing that it immediately says, before anything else, is that the E wave contours should obey this kinematic set of rules. Yeah?
What is X? Is X something physically measurable?
You'll see. Yes, it is, of course. So remember that the that what I'm going to try to predict from this kinematic rule is the contour of the Doppler E wave that you measure on echocardiography. And so X is going to be the integral on the... And so how do you validate it? You validate it by the usual methods. And this is what you do. You record a Doppler echo. You grab the frame. You pixelate it. You pick the points. And then you fit the solution to the equation of motion, which are cinches and cosches if it's overdamped, or exponentially damped signs if it's underdamped. And you see how close you get. Come, and then what happens is, of course, then you get values for the oscillator parameters, the dashpot, the spring, and the initial spring stretch. You can also do it for the A wave. I'm not going to talk about the A wave right now. I just want you to learn one thing. So here's the so the green thing is the model fit to the raw data. Okay, this is real data and real people with real hearts, with real echo machines, real everything, in vivo stuff. And so this is additional pictures of other people's echoes and how sort of the model fits the data. Now look, echo machine data is inherently noisy. And so you can say, hey, wait a minute. How come you didn't fit it a little further up, a little further down, and so forth? And the answer is, depend on what you set your threshold on the echo machine. You have to agree on something, which is a reasonable approximation to the contour that you measure by echocardiography. If you choose not to use an echo machine, but use an electromagnetic flow probe that you sew into the mitral valve, you get equally good fits. And so I'm not going to go back to the patterns I told you, and I didn't tell you the first time, I'm telling you now, that the black lines are model fits to the raw data. Okay? So it looks like a simple harmonic oscillator, which is linear, which is invertible, allows you to re-express clinically acquired E-wave contours in terms of a set of numbers. So that's better than saying big, tall, narrow, and so forth. And you can do other things with it. First thing you can do is answer this gentleman's question, which is, how come such a simple thing works? The answer is, it probably because it grabs the essential kinematics of the entire system. To check to see, there are other published models, mathematical models, of how the ventricle fills with blood. They're very complicated. They're partial differential equations, like 8 or 12 of them, with between 20 and 30 variables. You got to know the variables ahead of time to plug in to get a contour, to get a thing. But here's the answer. This is the comparison between the harmonic oscillator solution to a linear approximation to the complicated nonlinear models fit to a real E-wave in a real person. And see, relative to the noise in the E-wave, you can't tell the difference. And you get a bonus. The nonlinear ones, you can't invert. In other words, you can't walk up to the model and start with the Doppler E-wave and get your parameters back. The only way you can make those models work is you got to put in all the parameters first in order to plot the velocity as a function of time. The other things you get from kinematic modeling are an interpretation between the mechanical and physiologic components. What does it mean to stretch the spring a certain amount? Well, physiologically, the force in the spring is the equivalent of a maximum atrioventricular gradient between the atrium and the ventricle, when the ventricle goes, and so forth. You get other parameters, like 1/2 kx naught squared, which mechanically all of you understand from elementary mechanics, which has no obvious physiologic measure that people have been able to discern. This c squared minus 4mk, you see, is just a difference between the dashpot versus the spring, and tells you whether the thing is underdamped or overdamped kinematically. By the way, the prediction, this is overdamped, this is underdamped. So remember, one of the kinematic predictions that a simple model like this made is that when you look at an E wave, it has to obey really waves. It should be either underdamped or overdamped. And when you look, that's what you find. So this is what the model predicts, right? There's a spring is linear, it's bidirectional. Now, you can't talk about bi anything in California unless you define what you mean by bi. What I mean by bi is that the spring has, you know, if you go below a certain length, you compress it, it springs back. And then once you stretch it above that length, it pulls you back the other way. So it's got like an equilibrium length, okay? That's what bidirectional means. And it also makes the equivalent of this statement is a physiologic prediction that there is an optimal state for the ventricle. And that state is the state during diastasis. When the ventricle just sits there, there's no blood flow. The atrium and the ventricle are one chamber. The mitral valve is kind of floating in blood. And whatever that state of the ventricle is, that's the, quote, equilibrium state, because it is relative to that state that this kinematic phenomenon occurs. You can see with some of the other predictions that it makes. So what's the spring? That's a fair question to ask. So I should point out to you this harmonic oscillator idea. When I was a cardiology fellow, I wrote this paper some years ago, and people thought that they didn't know what the spring was, because nobody believed that heart cells by themselves, after they contracted, could spring back and push. That's not the general way that people believed heart cells worked. However, this guy, Helmes, and I have to say this correctly because I'm Hungarian, he's just pronounced Károly Trombitás. This means trumpeter, the name. And Hank Granzier, they did these very interesting experiments using rat heart cells. They took their heart cells, they glued them to a force transducer, they gave them calcium to give them a cramp, then they bathed them in a relaxing solution and measured the force as the cell elongated by itself. In other words, they got the spring to contract if there was an intracellular spring, then you get it to relax chemically, and then see what kind of force it generated. And this is the data. It's a linear bidirectional spring with an equilibrium length. So the answer to your question is that it just turns out, a good guess. Not surprising, because it fit the data so well, that a linear spring, in fact, is good enough to explain stuff at a micro scale. Now this is inside a cell. So is it fair for me to claim, I predicted that the Titan is a linear spring? No, it's a guess. And so the prediction that the model makes is that in order for you to explain the macroscopic physiologic data that you see on echocardiography in the form of E-wave contours, it suffices to approximate the kinematics with a linear spring. And then when people look at the micro level, indeed they find it. And then that's in a working regime, you see? And then if you stretch it, then you see that a nonlinearity declares itself, just like a rubber band. You know, a rubber band, when you stretch it a little bit, it's pretty linear, but as you get to the end of it, it does this, yeah.
What about the extracellular matrix?
That's the next question. So you know the answer to it.
I asked a question.
Okay, so the answer is, its bulk behavior must also be linear, because the extracellular matrix and the Titan must be working together when the ventricle goes boing, and you get a linear spring that explains the E-wave contour, which is due to everything, it's lumped. It's a lumped parameter model. So that it's probably true that the extracellular matrix, it also has nonlinear behavior globally, but on the scale of deformation that occurs in the normal ventricle, during normal E waves, it suffices to approximate it with a straight line. That's what the prediction is. To my knowledge, nobody's measured the extracellular matrix globally. Now you can, a very interesting thing happens. If you take a rat heart and you put it in sodium hydroxide and you melt away the cells, what you get back is the extracellular matrix skeleton looks like a sponge bowl, made of sponge, you know, with holes in it, because the holes is where the cells used to be. I don't know of anyone who has been able to measure the deformation of that very complex geometry and make any statements about its linearity. Yeah.
For
the sick hearts.
Yeah.
So it looks like we're making the right guess. Ignorance is useful. At least in my case. Look, the other thing that this kind of kinematic modeling does is sometimes you do an echo and you see this pattern in which basically the contour looks like this with a break. And I don't know what the biology is, but I can tell you what the kinematics is. I can tell you that the filling process went from underdamped to overdamped, probably meaning that some tissue element or some tissue compartment reached its limit of accommodation and essentially a different mode of constraint comes in. Now this is a kinematic argument. It's not a biological argument, okay? And there are lots of other degrees of freedom which could possibly explain this kind of phenomenon. So it's not unique. So I'm gonna quote Paul Dirac, because you know, you have a problem, you can solve it, and then you solve it, and you bump into other problems. It's the story of everybody's life. So here's another important feature that you should remind yourself of, which is that you know that the heart's beat. You've seen cardiac MRIs of the heart's going boing, 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 and your chest, your heart's going boing, 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 boing. But most of you are awake, and most of you are actually sitting still. In other words, you're not going like this. The fact that you're not going like this means something. It means that your four-chamber heart is pretty close to a constant volume pump. This idea is not new to me. It's due to these guys in 1932 who basically considered the physiology in utero of babies. And in babies, as you know, the lung is completely full of fluid. And so if you have the thoracic cavity and the four-chamber heart and the lung full of fluid, if the four-chambered pericardial sac were radially oscillating in and out, then fluid would have to go in and out through the mouth, you know, into the uterine environment with every heartbeat, and the inertial constraints and stuff wouldn't work. And that's a correct argument. And then Hoffman and Rittman in 85 used the dynamic spatial reconstructor, which is a giant X-ray machine at Mayo, and measured it. And one of my graduate students and I used some MRI images to basically look at this phenomenon in a little more detail. And I want to include in this modeling concept the implications of a constant volume pump. So here is your heart, and you've seen pictures like this, four chamber, right? Left ventricle, right ventricle, two atria. The point that I'm trying to make is that if you look at the outside, it doesn't change very much during the cardiac cycle. You don't see radial oscillations of the outside surface. You certainly see that the muscle gets thicker and the annulus comes down and the ventricular and atrial volumes reciprocate. When the ventricle gets small, the atrium gets big. But the statement here is that when you add up everything inside the pericardial sac, you almost get a constant. And so that's the hypothesis, and so now you do the experiment, right? Because it doesn't matter how elegant your idea is and how smart you are and how many hours you can stay up at night and concentrate on the same thing. If the experiment says you're wrong, you're wrong, assuming the experiment is done correctly. Important detail. Here's another view. Just LV outflow tract. I'm just trying to show you how pretty the whole thing is. Here's the atrium, here's the aortic root, here's the ventricle, a piece of the right side. And notice that the aortic root gets pulled down in anteriorly and systole. And notice that the back of the aorta is the front of the atrium. And so the way the atrium fills during systole is that the mitral annulus gets pulled down by the ventricle, and the aorta gets before it, so it goes like this. So it's a piston. So it turns out that the atrium is a suction pump during ventricular systole. That's how it fills. How do you know that? You know it by looking. And when you put a catheter in here, what does the pressure do? During the initiation of ventricular systole, as I drew it for you, look, it's right here. When the ventricle goes into systole, the atrial pressure drops first, and then it fills and comes back up again. So the point is that during this time, atrial volume goes up, atrial pressure goes down. So just like the ventricle during suction, the atrium is a mechanical suction pump for during the early part of its filling phase. Here's a short axis view. Okay, so this is where you pass the plane perpendicular to the long axis. And so your papillary muscles, you've seen all this. The point that I'm trying to make is that you get some motion of the outside surface, but it's pretty small compared to the endocardium, which goes radially substantially.
Yeah.
So I can kind of understand for the ventricle there could be an active sort of relaxation, but for a thin-walled chamber like the atrium, how do you explain sort of that?
Oh, I just showed you. So how does the atrium suck?
Yeah.
Okay, so the atrium sucks because the ventricle makes it suck. So the power for sucking in the atrium doesn't come from the atrium. It comes from the ventricle. Oops, I'm trying to go backwards. Okay? So the atrium sucks when the ventricle goes into systole. So it's like a piston, okay? And the power that moves the piston is the ventricle. The back of the atrium is glued to the back of the mediastinum. Remember the four rivets, which were the pulmonary veins? They stay put. So the atrial wall can't go in and out radially in the back. Stop. Did that help?
I think the atrial wall is that thin that the pressure difference across it, it will just easily move. So I think it's nearly open to the outside world.
The outside world meaning
the atria. I mean the atrial wall is that thin that the pressure inside the atrium is very closely related to the external pressure.
Sure. So there's no so there's
no suction.
No, the suction is not generated by the atrium. The suction is generated by the atrial chamber enlarging while the atrial pressure drops. So it's not the atrial wall is completely passive during this activity. And so all that, the purpose of the pericardium, it keeps the atrial walls up, and the ventricle pulls the annulus down, moves the aortic root forward, and so the atrium enlarges while its pressure drops. Yeah?
The volume is constant, but change, it accelerates the blood inside there. So still, there's some force there, and the force should cause that oscillation. The constant volume doesn't solve the problem.
Well, I'll show you what the constant volume does solve. Okay. So the problem isn't how it fills. Here's another picture of somebody else's atrium. All I'm trying to point out to you is you can see how the outside surface, see, here's a good example of the atrial wall of the LV, a left atrium just sits there in space while it's being moved up and, or this is right ventricle, left ventricle. The right ventricle is even more mobile apically, back and forth, yeah.
What about the role of the tethering of the atrial wall by the venous insertions?
On the right side.
And on the left.
Yeah, well, that's the whole point. The back of the atria are stuck to the mediastinum. They're not allowed to move radially. That's what keeps the thing open. Yeah.
But I think there's also the role of the negative intrathoracic pressure. Otherwise, it would attach at the back, pull the front, would just collapse on the other side. But it doesn't.
All of this works. All of this works if you hold your breath. You go scuba diving, whatever you want to do. So the intrathoracic pressure can act as a modulator of overall transmural gradient, but it won't change the kinematics. This one isn't playing. Okay, so this is what the data shows. If you plot pixels versus frame number in the four-chamber slice, remember? This is a test to see if the thing is really constant volume. By looking, by counting, you get a pretty flat line. I'm just showing you a rat heart because it turns out that rat hearts follow essentially the same rule. They wiggle inside the pericardial sac. There's not much radial motion. Now, if you do an open heart experiment where you crack the chest, make what's called a pericardial cradle, and you do all sorts of stuff, the constant volume property is destroyed. And you, perturbed, okay? The point is that then the atrium becomes the suspensory ligament that holds everything in place, and the atrium is so flimsy that it changes its entire set of properties. This is what happens if you measure total four-chamber heart volume in humans using three-dimensional data sets. So you can see that you have about 850 cc's in your four-chamber heart, and in systole it takes a little dip and then comes back up and refills in diastole. So what this shows is that the four-chamber heart is almost, not perfectly, but almost a constant volume pump. It's a constant volume pump about to within about 5%. So there's about a 40 cc deficit, maybe 45 cc's deficit, when your four-chamber heart goes into systole. And this is how that data is acquired, but using MRI and you stack them all up, you draw the lines, and you add up the voxels. This is supposed to be a movie of the pericardial sac for one cardiac cycle. And I don't know why it's not running. But what you basically see is the thing just sits there with just a little dimple that varies with the cardiac cycle. In other words, you don't see significant radial oscillations.
Hey, try clicking on the picture.
Try clicking on the picture. Let's see what happens. I don't know why it decides to misbehave. Let me try one more thing. Because it's worth having you understand. Let me escape.
That's not a movie. That's a picture.
Well, it used to be a movie about an hour.
You have to find the movie.
It lost its linkage.
Right.
And went away. Takamata. So let me go to here. If we have time, I'll come back to it. And so this is now for a whole bunch of people. Instead of a single individual, you take a bunch of graduate students, you buy them donuts, and then they go into the machine, and then you get the data. Okay, so this is normal physiology comparing the four-chamber size and the short axis views. And it's just showing you that there's just a little dip in systole. That's all. So now comes your question, which is, all right, okay, so suppose the heart really were a constant volume pump, 100%, not 95%, which is what it really is. What does that mean? Or what does it imply? Or what can you predict? So it means that kinematically, you should think of things sort of like this, as sloshing back and forth. And it means that if you look at the displacement of the annuli, they should follow oscillatory motion, and you come pretty close. Pretty close. So this is the atrial kick. You see, that's why it deviates from a sine wave. The other thing you can do now is you can say, let me just consider the left atrium and the left ventricle just together, two-chambered heart, and I'm going to make them constant volume. In other words, I'm just going to, for the sake of modeling, I'm going to just assume the atrium and the ventricle reciprocate exactly. And I'm going to draw a cartoon like this, where the upper half is the atrium, the lower half is the ventricle, and this is the mitral annulus that goes back and forth with a hole in it, which is the mitral valve. So you consider this, and you want to derive something testable. This is the rule. The rule is you make a model, it makes a prediction, you check to see if it's right. So the thing that you can derive from this simple geometry is the relationship between the velocity of blood flowing through the hole versus how fast the annulus moves. Right? By conservation of volume, it should be self-evident. And if you conserve volume for the ventricle and you assume an idealized geometry, this is in your mind's eye for a Doppler E and an A wave. This is how I think your ventricle works, even though that's not how normally, when a cardiologist looks at it, they think it works. No, this is, look, this is isotropic. It doesn't have any of the stuff. It just says if you start out with a certain amount of myocardium in systole, you still have the same amount in diastole. So the wall thins radially and the annulus must rise, with the outside dimension being fixed. Okay? So it's the fixing of the outside dimension, which is the constant volume invocation in this case. And the equation that you write for that cylinder is the area of the mitral valve plate times its velocity must be equal to the area of the mitral valve times the velocity of the Doppler E wave. Because that's just what it means. And so notice that this equation has variables on both sides, but now I can rewrite it algebraically. And I'm going to take the areas, put them on the left, put the velocities on the right, and now I used to have a time-varying quantity equals a time-varying quantity. Now it's a constant versus a constant. And so now you can see, is that right? And so what you do is you take a Doppler E wave and a Doppler A wave in a person, and you take what's called Doppler tissue imaging. It's Doppler except at a lower velocity, and you image the velocity of the annulus. This is LV, LA, RV, RA, interventricular septum. Remember on MRI, you saw the annulus go up and down in systole and diastole. That's what this does, and here's the velocity of the annulus as a function of time. And then nothing happens, and then the velocity of the the velocity of the annulus due to the atrial kick. Okay? So this is, remember, this is velocity. Just means it speeds up and slows down. Nothing turned around and changed direction here. Just velocity accelerates and decelerates. So I flipped that one over so you can see better. And so the prediction that this constant volume, the question is, what's it good for? Well, you can ask a question. You can say, is it really true that the ratio of these two curves is a constant? And you say, well, wait a minute. If you have a cylinder with a thing going up and down, then it's obvious that when the annulus, the washer, goes up, the fluid goes the other way, then the durations must be the same. So experimentally, right away, you see very interesting that when you measure the real data, the duration in time of how much time the annulus spends moving is shorter than the amount of time that you measure flow into the ventricle. Well, you don't get too worried about that because there's things called inertia and so forth. So it's perfectly okay for the annulus to stop moving and blood to still flow in if the ventricle expands radially. So it's not a lethal problem, but you can check. So now here is the ratio, which is predicted to be constant for a constant volume heart. And so you can see that for the first half past the peak of the E wave, you come pretty close. So the approximation of constant volume physiology is actually a pretty good approximation to reality for not the entire duration of the E wave, but certainly for the first two-thirds of it. And you can check in normal hearts versus abnormal hearts. And now comes the more interesting part, which is that people have noticed that when they take the ratio of the E wave and divided by the ratio of the annulus velocity called the E prime. People publish papers. They say, oh, we noticed that the E wave and the E prime wave ratio is linearly proportional to the end diastolic pressure, blah, blah, blah. No explanation given. The answer is, it's Hooke's law, and it's a consequence of the constant volume property. That's what it predicts. And so, the E over E prime ratio that people have measured, this is in the cath lab, done with Mohr catheters and real human data, gives you a pretty good R value. And remember, this is real in vivo stuff with real human physiology, showing that the ratio of the peak of transmitral flow to the peak annular relationship follows this rule. And you could compare it in heart failure people versus normal people, and you get a pretty good ability to differentiate between the groups. And although I started 2 minutes late, I'm going to keep going for a few more minutes because this is the last thing I want to talk about, modeling and physiology and imaging. So here we are back again to this thing and just a cartoon and an E-wave, And the equation of motion of how this kind of an oscillator works kinematically when the ventricle goes and fills with blood. The thing that I want to think about now is I want to think about, can I use this to predict or to derive a load-independent index of diastolic function? You've heard a lot of comments today about how everything depends on load. What load means is how much volume or pressure does the ventricle start out with before it squeezes. In other words, the end diastolic volume or the end diastolic pressure. And what I'm going to try to show you is that kinematic modeling allows you to get a handle on the concept and to propose a load-independent index. So I'm going to walk you through this quickly because I'm running a little bit out of time. And the statement here is you start out with your equation of motion, and certainly at the peak of the E wave, at this point, okay, the acceleration, the curvature is zero. So that all you have left is that. That's true for all harmonic oscillators. And now you can make an approximation that the initial force in the spring is linearly related to whatever the force is left in the spring at the time the spring reaches the peak. Okay? And the statement is that the reason this relationship with the slope m is the load-independent index is because this equation of motion is valid independent of load. So it's the physics, the kinematics, that allows you to predict it. So now again, you know, as always, we make a prediction that we check. So that's why you have graduate students. And you give them donuts, and you stand them on their head. You know, in electrophysiology lab, there's a tilt table. And so the tilt table, you strap people in it, and then you can make them horizontal, you can make them vertical, or you can, whatever angle you want. And the point is, this is a student upside down, and their echo machine, and the point is you use the tilt table, and you change load on the heart by just changing position and space. And even though I don't have a catheter in the atrium, this is a well-established method of changing load. So there's nothing mystical about it. It's been around for a long time. And so this is what happens. So here's a single individual with their E wave and A wave, head up, supine, and head down. You can see the heart rate changed, so you can see the duration of diastasis between them is somewhat variable. But the data is obtained after any heart rate transients go by. So notice that the relationship in this individual, you get a straight line between KX naught and Emax times C. So here's the same person repeatedly done with a pretty reasonable R square for human in vivo in the real world kind of data. Here's everybody. This is data from 15 people, head down, supine, and head up, and you get a pretty straight line. And so the question you can ask, what does the slope of that line mean? That's the load independent index. And that's what this slope is. And it tells you that it relates how much of the gradient manifests itself as delivered volume in filling the ventricle. That's like an efficiency index. So low slope implies a larger increase in the viscous loss for the same driving force, and vice versa. So here are the conclusions regarding this load-independent index idea based on imaging and modeling, which is that the filling patterns change as you change load position. You can obtain this index directly from kinematic modeling. You define it by the ratio of the peak driving force to the peak resistive force. It's a dimensionless parameter. It's the ratio of two forces. And all we've done is normal people so far, because we're waiting for human studies to do it in the cath lab. But the prediction, of course, is that in the case of pathology, the value for N will be less than in the case of normal, because it's a more inefficient filling process. The greatest utility of a load-independent index in clinical cardiology is when you are your own control. you have an echo today, I give you some ACE inhibitor or beta blocker or a diuretic or something, and you come back in 6 months and you have a different E wave. Your echo has changed. So the question is now, did it change because the load changed, or did it change because your heart changed? And this is one potential way of finding that out. So what I try to do is to give you some examples of how correlations observed previously in clinical cardiology can be put on a somewhat firmer footing based on some causal arguments using simple mechanics or kinematics. And here are just some selected examples, which is that the shape of E-wave contours obeys simple harmonic motion pretty accurately. It actually correctly predicted 10 years before Titan was measured to be a bidirectional linear spring that it has to be a linear spring that drives the filling process. Otherwise, you can't explain the E-wave contours that you observe. The constant volume approximation provides a very nice explanation for why people have observed a linear relationship between E prime and the E prime over E and the end diastolic pressure rate relationship. And also, you can use it to solve actually an interesting unsolved problem that's been a headache for many people for a long time, which is sort of a first principle based argument of how to get a handle on a load independent index. And I'm going to say that as my last slide, there's an infinite set of unsolved problems. It just depends on what you think is interesting and what you want to approach in the sense of spending your time on. This issue of stability versus instability is an interesting problem because people drop dead all the time from all sorts of things. And using nonlinear dynamics and other methods like that to see if the oscillator, what the criteria is for instability and can you predict it, in and of itself is has practical consequences. I want to acknowledge the sources of support for our research over the years, and that I'll stop with that. Thanks very much for your attention.